So as some of you may be aware, there's a brouhaha going on right now between the Trump administration and Harvard University over, let's just say, the foreign policy views of some members of the Harvard community. And it has resulted in the Trump administration threatening to cut and now apparently enacting cuts in federal research funding going to Harvard faculty and grad students. So grants from the NSF and National Institutes of Health and so forth are being put on hold, some canceled altogether. You know, here at the Mises Institute, we certainly don't want to put our own federal funding in jeopardy. And because we had Scott Horton yesterday giving us his views on the Russia-Ukraine conflict, in order to have greater viewpoint diversity, we've invited Bill Kristol to come and give his take on these issues. So, Bill, come on up. The joke's on you. We don't even have any federal research funding. I want to talk about, government funding of science and technology in general, but looking specifically at the origins of the National Science Foundation. The NSF is usually described as, sort of a neutral promoter of basic scientific research, which is useful in its own right, but also leads to many, spin-off technologies and other improvements in the quality of life. That's, of course, what you're hearing now. People who are upset about the situation at Harvard, lives will be lost and a lot of catastrophic damage will occur from cuts to federal research grants held by Harvard personnel. This is mainly a kind of a case study talk, but it's worth having a little tiny bit of sort of theory in the backs of our minds before we get into it. In the standard textbooks, the rationale for government subsidies for scientific research is the idea that science, or at least basic scientific research, is what mainstream economists call a public good. It has a number of sort of important spillover benefits that accrue to the private sector, to other actors, and the public goods nature of basic science means that it's very difficult for those who invest in basic science to profit from or to capture the economic returns to those investments. Therefore, the free market won't produce enough basic science, and the government has to step in. The usual ways that this argument is illustrated is by pointing to, successful or supposedly successful examples of innovations that were funded by or even, where the research was conducted by state actors, particularly during wartime. We'll get into those in a second. Keep in mind that there, even at this level of the conversation, there are some important theoretical challenges and difficulties, right? One is that, we don't really have a way of evaluating or measuring the value to society, the value to the market, the value to humanity of things that are not bought and sold in markets, right? So it's one thing for the scientist to say, this book that I've written, this article I've published, this thing that I discovered in the lab is going to have these enormous benefits for society. Does it? Does it not? We don't really have a mechanism for evaluating the merits of such activities outside of the market mechanism, how much people are willing to pay, to obtain a marginal unit of that thing. And when the thing isn't traded at all, this is all just kind of speculation, right? There's also a kind of a technical point that I think hasn't been as explored as much among Austrian economists as it could be, that the public goods characterization of basic science is probably not correct. There's a number of papers by Terence Keeley and Martin Ricketts and others characterizing scientific research as what they call a contribution good, by which they mean you have to be a contributor to that basic science to understand the work well enough to profit or benefit from it. So it's not the case that the benefits just spill over to the general public. They only spill over to other people who are also invested in doing the research themselves. As far as the kind of empirical case for the standard argument, what we most often see is, a list of a bunch of examples of successful innovations that for which government funding played a role. The standard bearer for this argument in our day is an Italian economist in the UK named Mariana Mazzucato, published a book called The Entrepreneurial State. She went through, you know, looked at the iPhone and said, well, if you trace back all of the technologies in an iPhone, you know, many of them had, you know, there was some involvement in that discovery process by federal labs or federally funded university labs and so forth. Therefore, government spending on science and technology is good. You know, you can probably immediately see the flaw. There's kind of a statistical or methodological flaw, you call it a logical flaw, in this kind of argument. The technical name for it is sampling on the dependent variable, meaning you can you pick if you pick a bunch of examples of useful innovations and then trace back the role that government funding played in them, that doesn't tell you what is the role of government funding for the average innovation activity. You're just picking a few winners and trying to trace backward. It's like those articles you see on, you know, your phone or whatever. You know, these billionaires do the following five things every day. They get up, they brush their teeth, you know, they make coffee. Therefore, if you do these things, you too can be a billionaire. It's exactly the same kind of argument. I just saw this 2 days ago in the New York Times. So yes, I updated these slides on the fly. Again, here it is. It's just a laundry list of, they talk about GPS and, you know, several other innovations in which federal funding played a role and claim, of course, the whole point of this article is to say Trump is bad, orange man bad, right, for cutting federal funding to Harvard. But of course, you could find just as many useful innovations that were not federally funded. This is just sort of cherry picking a few examples. It doesn't establish, it doesn't tell us anything about the average expected value of a dollar of federal science funding. Now, let's get to the case evidence a little bit. You know, during World War II and up to about 1950, when the National Science Foundation was created, there was quite a lot of federal funding, US government funding of scientific research. The biggest funder by far was the OSRD, Office of Scientific Research and Development, which was a World War II era agency that was funding research both in government labs and in private and university labs on a bunch of World War II era technologies, radar, to the Manhattan Project, and so forth. Okay, by the end of the war, this office was giving out about $500 million a year, constituting the majority of all federal research funding on science. And most of it was going to universities. So universities were the paid contractors who were executing these projects on behalf of the federal government. There were some private companies, too, that also received some federal funding. But you can see this was, you know, this is a very widespread, broad-based program. Some 600 projects at more than 80 universities were receiving OSRD funding through the end of World War II. There were a couple of other federal entities that were important science funders, the Office of Naval Research and the Atomic Energy Commission, which of course would become more important at the end of the war and up until 1950. So both of these organizations were also spending considerable amounts of taxpayer money to support scientists and researchers, again, who were mainly devoted to wartime technologies and some spin-offs of these wartime technologies. Well, during this time, this pattern of federal spending had a significant impact on what kinds of projects scientists worked on, the ways that scientists collaborated, and so forth. As, you know, a very well-known 20th century social commentator named Seymour Melman, who our good friend Tom Woods has written about, made the argument in a series of books and articles that the sort of national defense orientation of all of this federally funded research and development expense tended to bias or influence research in a particular direction, crowding out private funding for other research and development that would have taken place, okay? And Melman, even though he was known as a kind of a polemical writer, I mean, he was a social scientist. He did a lot of very detailed case studies. One was on the machine tool industry, which was one of his areas of specialization. And he pointed out that this industry during the 1940s became transformed into one that basically served a single customer, the Pentagon. And this had a number of impacts on what the industry was doing and contributed to this industry's failure in the post-war period. It was not internationally competitive, did not have a diversified set of capabilities because it had been serving exclusively one customer. And the failure of private investment to support other kinds of activity to develop the machine tool sector contributed to that sector's decline. Similar argument was made by the historian Paul Thorman, what he called the distortion thesis, or what has been called the distortion thesis, namely that if you look at some scientific fields, they were their kind of developmental path was altered by the influence of military objectives and military funding. You know, certain scientific fields like solid-state physics and quantum mechanics became more important than they otherwise would have because that's where all the federal dollars were going, right, especially for atomic, for nuclear projects. And also the transformation of the scientific enterprise to one where, you know, we're all sort of working together in a team for the common good, right, was a transformation of how scientists understood their roles with each other, their roles with society, their roles with funding agencies. You know, being asked to serve on a military commission as a scientist was a great honor. And so scientists were, of course, choosing projects and presenting the work in a way to make it more attractive to the people who could invite them to be on these commissions. Okay, so between the conclusion of World War II, or you know, in the years immediately following World War II, it was recognized that something like OSRD was not, was not designed appropriately for peacetime federal support for research and development, and so there were several proposals for some kind of a national science agency, national science organization, or national science foundation. Probably the most popular vision at the time for a national science agency was the one articulated by a man named Harley Kilgore. Kilgore was a senator from West Virginia. He was a New Dealer, a kind of a progressive populist type. And he believed that, you know, just as the New Deal had harnessed the resources of society under, you know, under the leadership of Washington, D.C., to pull us out of the Depression, we likewise needed to mobilize the scientific community to serve the common good under the guiding hand of the federal government. Science, he said, is a national resource, just like, you know, agricultural land or minerals or whatever, can't be left to decentralized processes of scientists and universities competing with each other. It needs to be organized by the federal government. He wanted to produce a cadre of trained scientists trained by the federal government and loyal to the needs and objectives of the federal government, which of course to him meant sort of, you know, proxy for the people at large. He thought that federally funded science should serve, you know, public interest, should serve national needs, including applied work and social science work. Government officials should be in control. In fact, he wanted Congress to be in control of how the resources were distributed, how projects were evaluated. He wanted things distributed equally across, you know, states and regions. And he wanted the government to own the intellectual property rights, the government to hold any patents that were to come out of federally funded research. Well, there was another competing vision of a national science agency around this time. And it was articulated by a man named Vannevar Bush, not related to the other Bushes. Vannevar Bush was a very important early 20th century engineer, public servant, intellectual. He was a successful inventor, had a number of important patents in radio tubes. He was a co-founder of the company that later changed its name to Raytheon. Come back to that in just a second. He was dean of the engineering school at MIT. Then he became president of Carnegie Mellon University, and he was the head of the OSRD during World War II. And Bush articulated a vision of a different kind of national science agency, one that would be controlled by scientists who would pursue scientific research on its own merits, outside of political interference. He wrote a famous lengthy essay that was published as a book called Science, the Endless Frontier in 1945, in which he argued, it sounds kind of like the standard arguments you get in mainstream text today, science is a public good and has all these spillovers, and to improve the lot of humanity, we need to spend more on basic science than what the market will allow. His vision of an agency is that it would not do any applied technical work. It would only do basic work, no social science. Scientists themselves would be in charge. The work would all be done in universities and governed by universities, not by federal labs. Projects would be selected purely based on their scientific merit as judged by other scientists, okay? So the public will write the checks, but the public will not have any influence on what gets done. So several bills were introduced in Congress in the 1940s. There was a bunch of, you know, intrigue and debate and jockeying for positions. The standard mainstream story, if you go to the NSF website and look at its little essay on the history of the NSF, well, the story you get is the following. Well, the foundation was established by Congress in 1950, and it was a full endorsement of the Vannevar Bush model of a scientist-led, basic science-oriented, pursuit of science for its own good kind of organization without any military, political, social kind of influence. The reality, as you can imagine, is more complicated. So for the younger members of our audience who like to see things in terms of memes, right, the sort of most common argument for why government should, you know, fund science is because of these spillovers. More sophisticated argument, well, you know, the private sector can do some research and development, but there are a few basic scientific issues for which the federal government has got to step in. Then the super sophisticated argument is supposed to be, well, there was this debate between, you know, the Kilgore model and the Bush model, and the Bush model won out, and the NSF was created to do basic science along the lines articulated by Vannevar Bush. But of course, the reality, okay, is that the true NSF was kind of a compromise bill that reflected elements of both the Vannevar Bush proposal and the Harley Kilgore proposal. It was not independent of federal influence. It was not independent of the military, contrary to what is typically sort of just the typical way you hear this. Okay, so what did the NSF look like, the NSF as it was created? Well, it does emphasize basic research, not applied R&D, conducted in university labs rather than government-owned labs. Priorities and disbursements are generally set by scientists, not by, you know, congressmen or whatever, through peer review. Universities can own the patents, and universities make billions today out of patents that they receive from federal funding. That's one of the controversial issues that Trump has raised. However, at the same time, the head is appointed by the president, subject to Senate confirmation, the budget is established by Congress, and there is a mandate in the NSF charter to develop what they call national priorities, to direct science in the interests of the nation, as articulated by the federal government, and to evaluate the research activity of federal agencies. There's also a mission to train and to fund and train a bunch of scientists. Now, you know, it's a lot of using woke criteria, of course. There is funding for social science. So the NSF certainly does have a mandate, at least an implicit mandate, to organize itself and to support activities that in some sense are consistent with national priorities, whatever those might be. And incidentally, you know, the concerns raised by people like Melman and Foreman, you know, those concerns were already, their concerns were already being realized, or the things they were worried about were already taking place, the crowding out, the distortion. It's not the case, as you sometimes hear, well, the NSF reversed all that, right, by taking science away from military, de-emphasizing military needs and allowing for, you know, bottom-up sort of peer-reviewed scientific progress purely on its own merits. Science continued to be dominated by Cold War concerns in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and even to some extent today. I mean, it's certainly important to keep the military context in mind, right? We never would have had this conversation about the need for a national science agency had it not been for the Second World War and the belief, right, that the reason the Allies won the war because of their superior science, okay? Manhattan Project being the most obvious example, but also radar, right? And even things like logistics and procurement, statistical analysis, some of you have seen this diagram that people use, you know, in memes and so forth to criticize mistaken kind of causal reasoning. You probably know this is the economist and statistician Abraham Wald was the is the one to whom this argument is credited, that, you know, his agency was looking at the planes that returned from bombing runs, and the military official said, oh, well, you know, we'll just mark all the places where they have bullet holes, and then we'll reinforce those parts of the planes. And Wald said, no, you've got it exactly wrong. Right? It's the opposite. The planes that made it back are the planes that took bullets here. So if the places where there are no bullet holes, those are the ones that bring the planes down. So you need to reinforce the parts of the plane where there aren't any bullet holes. Milton Friedman, by the way, was part of this effort as well as a young statistician. So there was also a concern that, you know, the market is not producing enough scientists, and therefore we need the NSF and similar agencies to train and fund scientists. I don't know if you've read Rothbard's article on science, which is written in 1959, but only recently published here at the Institute. And Rothbard points out that, look, I mean, being a scientist is a contribution to the labor market, just like any other kind of labor activity. If there's a genuine shortage, then wages will rise to clear the shortage. There's no evidence that the number of scientists that we have on the free market is less than the optimal amount somehow. You know, there's also Bob Higgs's ratchet effect. Someone mentioned that earlier at the conference. You know, all the key personnel like Vannevar Bush, right, who was the first head of the NSF, they were performing essentially the same functions that they had been performed, or parallel or analogous functions to the ones that they had performed at a wartime agency. You know, the scientific enterprise was now transformed towards one in which understanding government contracts, knowing how to get federal grants was, you know, part of what it meant to be a scientist. And then also this point that I mentioned before, that the idea that scientists should work on teams, you know, like the Manhattan Project, right? There's a lot of, you know, esprit de corps. We're a group with a leader, and the leader is pushing us to solve some big social problem. You know, a grand challenge is the language that they use today. Think of like the UN's, you know, sustainable development goals. I don't know how many university meetings I've been in where, you know, the list of these SDCs is presented. Now, which UN goal are you scientists, are you researchers going to tackle, right, as a group? It's interesting, I was just thinking about the contrast between this and Mises' description of the creative genius. There's a discussion in Human Action, but a more concise one in his book Bureaucracy, where Mises says, society cannot contribute anything to the breeding and growing of ingenious men and women, I guess. A creative genius cannot be trained. A genius is precisely a man who defies all schools and rules, who deviates from the traditional roads of routine and opens up new paths through land inaccessible before. He does not owe anything to the favor of those in power, but on the other hand, the government can bring about conditions which paralyze the efforts of a creative spirit and prevent him from rendering useful services to the community. So the scientific genius was transformed from this into what you think of as, you know, the PI at a federally funded research lab at Harvard or Columbia or anywhere else, where the main job is to appease politicians, to get grants, right, and not to buck any conventional wisdom on any topic whatsoever. Okay. Now, there are a number of studies by, you know, recent studies by social economists and other social scientists on the impact of the NSF and similar agencies. There's a very interesting NBER paper on the OSRD, which is essentially claiming that there were large positive spillovers from OSRD funding, but also including the claim that this defense-related funding permanently changed the trajectory of overall U.S. innovation in the direction of OSRD-funded technologies. Okay, so what would markets for telecommunication and computing and aviation and other sectors look like had the funding come from private sources? Well, it's possible to identify and describe that counterfactual precisely, but it would almost surely be different from the pattern of scientific development that occurred during the Cold War, largely due to government funding. Now, there are studies that look at the impact of government funding on specific outcomes, like the amount of R&D that private firms do, the amount of patents that private firms get, how scientists do in their careers, typically showing a positive relationship. Right, so when the government spends more on scientific research, you get these other beneficial spillover outcomes. But I just want to emphasize for you what the outcomes are, right? The amount of R&D that private companies do, the amount of patents that private companies get, and the career advancement of government-funded scientists. Well, I mean, it's probably not shocking that there's some positive correlations there. You could call it cronyism if you want. Right? It's not the same thing as establishing societal benefit from government science funding. For example, as I mentioned before, it's impossible to measure the impact on socially useful innovation, which is not the same thing as R&D expenditures by large corporations or patents, right? And you know, even if you found a few cases where, you know, look, I'm glad I have GPS in my mobile phone, that's very useful, but you know, you need to look at the, you know, what they call the average treatment effect, right? So there's a lot of variety in the sense that the vast majority of federally funded research projects produce probably negative social impact, right? Think about the humanities, okay? Or maybe a neutral impact. There's a lot of heterogeneity there. You know, we're putting government-funded actors in charge of picking winners. You have a politicized research university. I mean, it's no surprise that all the stuff going on at Harvard, Columbia, et cetera, is going on now, right? Because these university actors are primarily those who are chasing federal funds rather than people who are doing, you know, scientific research. Okay. I've written before and spoken before about kind of, you know, broader issues with the notion of using taxpayer funds for science, kind of where I started the talk today. Well, one is the assumption of what you might call the linear model or the naive linear model of science in which, you know, scientists unconcerned with applications do very basic research that spills over into some applied research, then private actors do research and development, and eventually you get useful gadgets, right? That it sort of things sort of flow from basic to applied to commercializable and so forth. That model is almost certainly wrong descriptively, and even if you think about it theoretically, Rothbard talks about this in his article that I mentioned, a great book by David Noble, which I highly recommend on the role that sort of tinkering by private actors plays in stimulating even basic scientific advances. But you know, at the end of the day, the model that is proposed here is one in which scientists, kind of like the Fed, where's Jonathan? Kind of like the Fed, are, you know, independent, but engaging in their independent activities at the taxpayer's expense. Okay? So as a result, we have all the problems that we've already been describing. Their scientists have been transformed from scientists to grant hunters and grant diggers, and that gives them lots of incentives to lobby even more for more federal funding. So scientists themselves are among the most up in arms at the proposed cuts to federal research funding among universities today, including, by the way, just proposing to cut the overhead rate that universities charge on federal grants. So it almost sometimes seems like a lot of this is about scientists who just want to be able to do more science on your dime. Okay, so to end with another meme, because I'd like to give an entire presentation in memes sometime, but you know, you might think that scientists just want your money, and the sophisticate tells you, no, this is about basic research and spillovers and public goods, blah, 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 but probably at the end of the day, the scientists just want your money. Thank you.